Welcome to episode 03 of Talk Geek to Me, the fourth episode of Talk Geek to Me. Today on Talk Geek to Me, the feature presentation, the feature segment, will be a software review of Lex, a document editing system, not a word processor, mind you, but a document production system. Revisiting Latin American software news with just one feature article, listener feedback, and of course, closing song. So, thanks for tuning in to this internet radio. I haven't called it internet radio in a while, and I hope you enjoy. Let's talk about Lex. Lex is a document preparation system. It is not a word processor, although it gives you all the features you expect from a word processor, without the problems of a word processor. You see, most word processors are based on emulating typewriters, which is a fine approach for people of my generation, who started on typewriters, but a lousy approach for people who were born after the typewriter disappeared. Why are people learning to make documents as if they were using a typewriter when the typewriter hasn't been used in about 2 decades? I speculate force of habit, but the whole idea of the computer is that the computer does the grunt work for you, and you do the stuff people are good at, which is creating. The reason the typewriter paradigm is flawed is because when you work as if you were using a typewriter, you are forced to concern yourself with the appearance of the material on the piece of paper. How things are spaced, the size of the letters, tab stops, all of that stuff distracts you from writing the document. For any example, if you start with a typewriter mode, you start by making a choice of fonts, tab points, font sizes, etc. With Lex, you use the modern approach, you write, and you tag the things with what they are. Then choose what it is, and Lex does the grunt work for you. So let's say you were going to write a report. You would start by writing an introduction, and then you would choose section to tell Lex you are starting a new section. Then you would type introduction and begin typing paragraphs. In other words, Lex is not a what-you-see-is-what-you-get system. Lex is a what-you-see-is-what-you-mean system. Now you may say that modern word processors can be moved to this style of work, but the difference is that word processors are based on that old way of doing things, and what-you-see-is-what-you-mean is a recent addition to them, whereas Lex is based on a typesetting system called LaTeX, which has been around for 20 years and is proving to work. LaTeX? WTF? Okay, we all know that in the world of Unix and Linux, that you have a bunch of specialized programs. Note that this does not mean that there is no LaTeX for MS Windows. There is. But it's the same thing here, specialized programs. So TeX is a typesetting program, actually one that originally was too much for early PCs of the 80s, but works fine on them now. LaTeX is an extension to TeX that breaks TeX out of being a thing for typesetters. It allows things like macro creation and definitions of what different kinds of documents are worked on in a uniform manner. So Lex is a front end for LaTeX that acts to give you a good user interface, and LaTeX gives direction to TeX, which is a typesetting engine. LaTeX then produces PDF files, you know, portable document files, and its related device-independent form, the DVI file. These can be converted to PostScript formats for printing. Of course, the fun doesn't end there. Since Lex is already programmed to call other programs, it can call a variety of programs to create a variety of formats. By installing programs with it, you extend the functionality. You can use programs to import and export HTML, web pages, create Linux documents, stuff like man pages, etc. Use RCS, which is Revision Control System, DocBook formats, as well as the WV suite for converting Microsoft formats. If you add one of these programs after installation, you select the Reconfigure item from the Tools menu, and Lex automatically detects the software and sets itself up to use it. Of course, this is all in addition to being able to add classes of documents to it. Some moderated journals have their own class for electronic submission, as well as some universities having their own class for thesis submission. So you may ask, you know, what is using Lex like? Well, using Lex is a breeze. It has drop-down menus like any modern program, so you start typing, only you tell it what things are as you go along. So, I typically use the article document class. There's also the book, the report, and the letter classes, and you can import more if you need more. So I would start like anything else. I would go to the File menu and choose New. Then I would choose Save As with the blank document. But that's me. I like to click the Save icon later and know where it's going to go. Then I begin typing. If I type a title, I use the pull-down menu and choose Title. If something is a section start, I use the pull-down menu and mark something as Section. Lex does the rest, numbering the sections, using uniform fonts and headers, consistent styles for everything else. When I want, I click the PDF icon, and it launches KPDF, which is the KDE PDF viewer, and shows me what it would look like. When I am ready to wrap up, I go through a typical click the spell checking icon and go over the spelling. It is, of course, multi-tabbed, and there are other functions I barely use, but I know they will work when needed. The only other things you need to know about Lex for the purpose of this review is that it's available in all major repositories, as well as having installs for Windows, Mac, and OS 2. It's a GPL program and is also available in the source. It operates in 26 languages. The Windows page has specific setup instructions for 10 languages. Full support for languages that operate right to left. Web page URL will be in the notes, as well as one for a Wikipedia article. But the URL for the Lex project is easy enough to spell out for the podcast. It's www.lyx.org/HOME, H-O-M-E. Okay, continuing our experimental segment, open source news from Latin America. You know, this is like my third retake of this, but there's one that's really long, and I want to make sure I read this one to you, because I think it's interesting. You might think it might sound like anti-American, but it's really about money, really about financial involvement and public education. Of course, I'm reading this stuff from a news website called news.northxsouth.com, which is great if you want to see the other stories there. There's plenty of interesting content, but this one is really good. All right. April 30th, 2009. Open Source Index reveals more than just usage stats. The sad case of technology education in the United States. Filed under Brazil, Digital Rights, and Free Software. The Open Source Index is a collection of rankings based on research at Georgia Tech. Recently, Red Hat made the findings available via an online web application. It might be arguable that Spain and France rank higher than Brazil, ranked number 3, in government adoption of free software, but the rankings show that large governments who could be doing amazing programs, like the United States, which ranks 28, are being beaten out by developing nations like Venezuela, Peru, South Africa, Indonesia, Vietnam, and even Costa Rica, whose population is only 4 million. A lot have blogged about this web app from Red Hat, but perhaps the OSI data could be used as a technology policy corruption index when combined with lobbying data for companies like Microsoft. After all, when was the last time an impoverished kid who would benefit from free software wine and dined a U.S. senator? The real-world impact of technology policy failures in the U.S. using an example from a public education system to illustrate what it means to be left in Brazil's dust on technology education policy. You can go to Adams Memorial Middle School's Computer Lab homepage, graciously hosted by Tripod, and you'll get a pop-up ad when you click to enter the site. We got a scantily clad woman selling a weight loss scam. What will you get? Venturing further inside, there were 3 amusing Google AdWords ads, online high school, homeschooling, and Stratford Private School. Meanwhile, their technology strategy includes upgrading word processing programs to Microsoft Word, sometime in fiscal year 2008, and standardizing on district-wide word processing to 2 tiers of Office 2007. When one takes a look at their technology plan financial worksheet, one can see that an astounding $50,000 is allocated to this standardizing on district-wide word processing to 2 tiers of Office 2007 task. How can upgrading a word processing program take so much money away from this school's technology budget? Meanwhile, the Brazilian government supports the Brazilian version of OpenOffice, and has already installed 40,000 copies at 2,000 schools in the state of Paraná for nothing in software fees. Nationally, Brazil is building 53,000 computer labs that will serve 52 million students using entirely free software. According to the World Bank, the U.S. is the fourth richest country in the world compared to Brazil's ranking of 66. Now, we don't mean to pick on the Adams-Cheshire Regional School District in Massachusetts. They honestly were just the first public school to come up in a Google search, and we don't really know anything outside of what we've learned via online searches. They seem to be relatively better off than many parts of the country. But that's kind of the point. One can take any public school in the U.S. and see what the policy of proprietary knowledge and closed technology has wrought. That said, there is a glimmer of hope in one of the line items of their technology strategy document is investigate new software that would actually be used to enrich, extend, and supplement the curriculum. We would argue this school district and all the public school systems who are fighting the well-known battle to provide quality education to U.S. students to investigate new software that could provide a more coherent, cutting-edge technology education at lower costs with the help of free software movement. For more information on the impact of technology policy on U.S. education policy, you can also see, and it refers to another public website. So I only wanted to feature that one item from Latin American Software News because I thought it was so explosive. Well, a software review alone is a scant material for a Talk Geek to Me episode, so I thought it'd be a good time to interject a few updates to prior podcasts I've done for Hacker Public Radio. I've noticed by looking at my statistics pages that a lot of people just listen and don't read the accompanying scripts or articles that I put up on the web pages, which is absolutely fine, but in order to have a sense of completeness, it behooves me to, you know, give short updates so I can explain what I've found out since. And one thing that I want to talk about is I did an episode called Hacker Public Radio number 71, Beowulf Cluster Introduction, where I talked about the Beowulf Cluster. Put one together, and if you recall, the Beowulf Cluster is a simple architecture where you take a couple of machines and boxes and you put them to work for a main computer. They have their own network to pass the work along that, so you don't get interference from your regular network on the head node. You know, Dan, another HPR podcaster, as well as having his own show, Linux Link Tech Show, very good show, by the way, emailed me, you know, how did you set this up without, you know, installing the standard message passing interface. These things are normally used for people who have big computational needs. I mean, computational needs that go beyond multi-core work. To give you a concept, millions and millions of calculations. Let's say you were doing something heavy like mathematically simulating a nuclear bomb blast. You would have to create three-dimensional grid of areas and update them for like every tenth of a second as to what the pressure changes and heat changes were from the original blast and update all these grid items. These calculations can run for hours, and more than hours sometimes. And another thing that real heavy-duty Beowulf uses for is meteorology, where each area is a cell, and the weather in that area depends on what the other cells are doing. So you have all these complicated calculations that feed into each other, and so you have this standard suite of programs called MPI that give messages back and forth from the processes across different nodes. The way I got around this was that I chose a ridiculously serializable task of taking multiple animes and converting them from the AVI format to the Theora format. So there's no need for the processes to communicate with each other whatsoever. And it was a good thing to have. I got that task done over a whole series in a third of the time. It was great. But it's not something I used every day. There was a maintenance requirement to keep the software updated and so forth and so on. It stopped working at one point. I never fixed it. Some things to note is that what we're talking about with the Beowulf cluster is we're talking about performance computing. Technology changes so fast that a computer purchased a year or so, or maybe 2 years down the road, may be faster than a small cluster. So if you really want to be on top of the game in having your own cluster, the thing to do would be to have like three cases and buy a closeout motherboard every year and be constantly rotating the motherboard, a new motherboard into the oldest one and updating your system that way. Because in 3 years, your hardware can be replaced by a multi-core processor that just has more cores, faster CPU cycles, whatever. So that's a lot of work to do something just for geek cred, as they say. The other thing is, and some people, and I thought I was like this, and, you know, actually I received a message that I could take old computers and just string them together and make one big computing cluster. The thing with that is that because of the advances in speed and technology, it's that every generation of processor gets more cycles, more compute cycles, for less wattage. In other words, this is not a green project. You know, you're throwing electric down the tubes when a new board can do what a couple of your old nodes did. Also, you know, please note that my rental situation is utilities included. I don't have to pay for my own electric, so I don't even know what I was paying for electric when I had three nodes going. I'm grateful for that situation, that I'm spared that expense. I had to bring you up today on the Beowulf cluster situation. Now, the other one, what has become one of the most popular web pages and podcasts I've done in the past, has been running Linux on compact flash. If you want a quick synopsis, is that I took a compact flash card, bought a reader, experienced a 3x speed increase on loading software than using disk drives. Some things came about as a result of this that I note with interest. And one is that all of a sudden, yeah, I got my software into memory faster. Now what about the data? You know, because all of a sudden you're ripping an MP3, You're making OGs out of a CD that you have. Hitting the disk drive was like hitting a brick wall. It was horrible. You know, not only that, but on my window manager, I have the CPU status monitor and the wait cycles I have set to come in white. It was minuscule. You know, minuscule is just one big white block of wait cycles. It was ugly. So I eventually had to get RAID, splitting the work of the disk storage system between two devices just to keep up with the speed of the CPU. Wanted to do three disk drives for RAID. Found out that my case only supports two disk drives. Well, that was a surprise. You know, that's something about these projects that's important to note, is when you get geekier and geekier and do weirder and weirder, more non-standard things, you're going to find out these little surprises down the road. Found out that I needed to do RAID. And RAID is a good system. I probably should do an episode just on RAID. But basically what you're doing is you're splitting disk storage between two disk drives. So each of the disk drives gets half the writes at one half the speed. And because RAM is like an order of magnitude faster, or maybe even two orders of magnitude faster than the disk drive, you just get everything just goes twice as fast. And with the RAID array of two disks, I'm very, very happy. And I'll down the road, I'll do a RAID episode. So, but that's it. You know, I had computers working fast. I had to speed up loading the software, and then I ended up having to do something about disk speed. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I had the home directory on the compact flash drive, and I was surprised to find out exactly how many programs expect to be able to use your home directory for temporary files. You know, as expected, everything should go to the /temp hierarchy. So I found like Firefox had two profiles of Firefox running, so I had all these images from every web page being written there until I would overflow my compact flash drive. So I eventually solved this problem by using soft links and pointing to my regular RAID array. So I would have to go in there and find out what link, what directory Firefox would be expecting to dump all this stuff in, make a soft link to something in my real home directory on the disk drives. My small compact flash drive would fill up with random images. Also, QuickShow, spelled with a K, KDE's slideshow program, likes to put its deleted files on the home directory too. Had to move that also. So you got this, you're having a small drive, you have this overflowing problem. And also eventually I had exhausted my searches for lightweight alternatives, and I found the really heavy clunker programs with full features that I want to use in addition to my array of lightweight applications. So then my software program expanded until I began using the Squash file system to compress it down to fit on the compact flash drive. Now, the Squash file system is a compressed file system. I got another speed boost just for using that. It was actually faster to pull a compressed block or a compressed directory off the compact flash drive, the user hierarchy therein, and decompress it rather than have all the small files on that drive. That really surprised me. But that also leads me to think that since RAM is an order of, is a one or two orders of magnitude, which is 10 to 100 times faster than disk-style devices, that maybe the solution to my speed demon desires might be to create a compressed file system of my user directory and just copying that into a blown out, you know, exploring out the memory on my motherboard and copying that into a RAM disk and accessing all my software there. That might be the next step. But so you're going to have surprises. I want you to know you're going to have surprises if you emulate that experiment, that you're going to have overflows. Be on the lookout for it. And that concludes these updates to prior HPR episodes. Hi, it looks like it's time to wrap things up for episode 03 for Talk Geek to Me. I neglected to give my contact information closing out the last show. So, email. You can always email me any kind of feedback you want. Love getting listener email. It's really encouraging. Helps keep me going. My email address is dg@deepgeek.us. That's deltagolf@deltaecho echo papa golf echo echo kilo.uniformsierra. I also maintain a small email list of people who would like to get notified of new episodes by email. Drop me an email, let me know you want to be on it. I'll be glad to put you on it. And I always love getting email, so please feel free. The website, of course, is talkgeektome.us. And my personal website, where you'll find all my personal episodes of the other show I'm a part of, Hacker Public Radio, mirrored, is deepgeek.us. And today's closing music will be a piece by a group called Sevish, called Consciousness. And it is, of course, from those wonderful guys at Podsafe Audio, letting us promote all these independent artists. So, enjoy, and thanks again for listening.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.